Hello, and welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. If you enjoy this conversation, there are a few different ways you can support us. You can buy a book from our online store, shakespeareandcompany.com, including the title discussed in this episode, a link to which you'll find in the show notes. There, you'll also find our Year of Reading subscription, as well as Shakespeare & Company totes, apparel, mugs, and other gifts, all shipped from Paris to wherever you are in the world. You can also become a friend of Shakespeare & Company, a programme we set up to get the bookshop through this difficult year. Membership gets you access to exclusively produced content throughout 2021, as well as other treats depending on the tier you choose. Contributors so far include Molly Crabapple, Aishan Hutchinson, Olivia Lang, Deborah Levy, Kartika Nair, Clemence Poesy, Natalie Portman and George Saunders. You can find out more on friendsofshakespeareandcompany.com. Finally, you can rate this podcast wherever you listen, and if you have time, leave a review. It can really help spread the word. I'll be back at the end. Until then, thank you for listening and enjoy the Shakespeare & Company podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Jennifer Lucy Allen, journalist, broadcaster, and now author of The Foghorn's Lament, one of the strangest, most haunting, and oddly moving non-fiction books to be published this year. It's a book about foghorns, of course, but it's also about coastlines, culture, and communities. It's an investigation into obsession, a miscellany of maritime mythology, and an inquiry into what makes one person's noise another person's music. And to a coastal boy who's been locked down in Paris since last March, who hasn't seen the horizon in more than a year and a half, it was not only an enormous pleasure to read, but also a balm. Jennifer, welcome to the Shakespeare & Company podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for that lovely introduction.
My pleasure. Thank you for the book. And I mean that very sincerely when I say it was a balm, like the sort of... We'll probably get into this because, of course, you were not born by the coast and didn't grow up there. And yet I think there is something incredibly powerful about the coastline, about being able to see the horizon. And particularly after the last year and a half of not being able to, it's something I've really come to appreciate.
Yeah, I definitely felt that, like most of the writing of the book, I was living in Southend-on-Sea in Essex and realising what it means to live near a coastline and not just visit one where you see all the changes happening in that landscape.
And so that sort of was a lot of this book was written when you were living by the sea then?
Yeah. So I moved out to Southend-on-Sea probably around the same time I started the research for the book, which started out as a PhD, not a very useful one. But living there really taught me a lot about weather and the coasts and coastlines as places, and also about seaside towns in the UK especially. And that's something that I didn't ever have before, in terms of seeing how things change hour to hour and day by day, and actually sitting somewhere and watching the tide go in and out day after day. It's a different experience of those places, which it sounds like what you grew up with.
Yeah, and I think also like with the tides particularly, watching the different sort of life that a high tide or a low tide brings out. And I don't mean just maritime life, but the sort of the human life around it.
Yeah.
Where are you at the moment when we're recording this? Because a part of me hopes you're going to say the office, which you write a little bit about in the book.
Yeah, no, sadly, that office still exists, actually. I heard they were looking for a new member a while back. But I actually, in lockdown, moved reluctantly back into London for various reasons to do with like moving in with my partner, who was allowed to come back from Sweden, and none of my friends, all of my friends refusing to leave London, and also kind of missing the sort of cultural obsessions to do with music and film and stuff like that, and wanting to see more of it, which there wasn't very much at the seaside.
I think I should probably let our listeners know why I seem particularly interested in the office that you talk about in the book. And one of the reasons from my perspective is that you say that it was the same estuarial landscape that opens Heart of Darkness, which I think for me it's one of the greatest novels of the 20th century, but also I think one of the greatest openings in literature, the way that Conrad evokes the estuary and evokes the coastline.
Yeah, that space... That specific space of the estuary is something that really taught me a lot about coastlines, not as idyllic places as well. Like the estuary is a mix of all these different things, and there's a lot of industry on it. There's a lot of history on it. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't work anymore, and there's a lot of ecology as well, and sort of the way that those places developed along the coast in Essex is really fascinating to me. And then always being able to see Kent across the water, apart from when it's foggy, you're sort of connected to somewhere else but far away from it, and the way that that affects the kind of general mood of a place, and that even comes across in Conrad, this idea of you're not far away but you're not close to London, and you're not at the sea yet, and it's kind of this middle space. Like, I'm really trying hard not to say liminal here because I don't think it's a liminal space. But it's very hard to say anything like very definite about it. It's full of contradictions.
Mm-hmm. Although that sense of liminality is something which is kind of very important to your book, because I think that there's been a lot of writing about the sea in recent years. I have the impression, like lots of books about the sea. I mean, some of the listeners to the podcast will have probably heard Philip Hoare talking here several times. And, you know, Philip writes wonderfully about Wales and about the sea and the deep sea, and the sort of the space is sort of quite far away from the coastlines. But one thing I realized while reading your book was that it's actually very rare to find people writing about this, about the coast, about the shoreline, about this space which is sort of not quite land, not quite water. And it struck me that it's sort of in a way it must have been quite a hard pitch to a publisher and to readers, to kind of not only to sort of that it's sort of you're writing in a space which is perhaps neither one thing nor another, but you're also writing about this object, this thing which people will have heard of but maybe won't have any particular sort of emotional connection to if they never had any direct experience of it. So would you be able to give us a little bit of an insight into how this interest in foghorns came about?
Yeah, I mean, the root of my interest is from is because of my background in music writing and journalism and broadcasting and stuff like that, and my specialism in those areas has always been writing about kind of experimental or underground recordings, like the avant-garde, a lot of stuff to do with field recording and things like that. So I was already kind of listening to things, not particularly looking for obviously like rhythm or melody. I love that, but I don't require it in things that I love. So when I was actually reviewing a record with a big French horn in it, and I was writing a review and sort of said, oh, this sounds like a foghorn, and then kind of went back to fact check myself and was thinking, oh, actually, what does a foghorn sound like? Have I got that right? And then just ended up in this complete YouTube hole. And I had all these questions about this sound. Like, I am always very curious about where sound comes from. It's a very sort of transient thing, but it fixes so much in our memories as in terms of our biographical sense of ourselves is like peppered with music and sound. So I sort of started asking these questions, like, whose idea was this sound? Because it's an enormous... We're familiar with it as a part of maybe sound effects, as bits of film. It crops up in literature and various bits of music. But actually, and it's kind of culturally familiar, particularly in Europe, actually, and North America. But then when you think about what it is, it's this absolutely massive horn on a coastline. There's nothing else like that. And once I'd been like, oh, God, I just assumed what this thing is. So whose idea was this? It's ridiculous. It's like completely absurd. And something about the absurdity of its scale and its power, but also the profundity of it being in this quite quite dramatic landscape, whether it's on a cliff top or a beach or a sort of shingle spit, really appealed to me. Like those, and I think what you were saying about liminality before, the thing that I loved writing about the coasts is you're not really able to say anything fixed about them. Everything requires a caveat or a but, and and the capacity of these spaces to be two things at once, and a coast can be two things at once. It is, you know, it's, and a foghorn can be two things at once. It's both about life and death, and so is the coast. Like, it's about life and death, mm-hmm. and it's about movement and stasis. It's where the fixed land meets the moving sea. And so I still can't quite shake that really compelling way in which not just the sound of the foghorn, but the landscape in which it's found can sort of contain multitudes, as it were, and contain opposites.
Mm. And that is interesting what you say about the way that sounds fix in our memories, because there are so many different ways that sort of memories can be evoked. It might be by a taste, it might be from a smell, it might be, you know, some sort of visual stimulus. But all of those things, to an extent, can be kind of recreated and fixed physically, I guess, whether that be in a picture, whether it be in, you know, I don't know, recreating the, you know, grandmother's old recipe or something like that. But sound, I think particularly a sound like a foghorn, even though, of course, there are ways of recording sound, one impression I got from the book was because of the massiveness of the foghorn, the sound the foghorn produces, it's kind of, you know, like on the YouTube videos you were watching, it's one of those sounds which sort of, you can have a representation of it, but you're never going to really get a sense of what a foghorn is and the sheer force of it until you actually hear one.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the notion of context for the foghorn, and then how that trickles down to the notion of context for all our sensory experiences, actually became a very sort of powerful backbone to the way I was thinking about things and the way I was writing about things, and really trying not to be prescriptive, because what I realized when even writing about a sound like the foghorn, which at first glance seems fairly esoteric, is that everyone has their own experiences of it. Like some of the keepers that I talked to, they hated it, and I'm there like, oh my god, I love this sound, it's so evocative, and it's this and it's that. And and lots of people, when I've talked about this project, like, it's had a lot of tangents over the years, and performances and things like that. And one of the things that I didn't expect was people coming up after and saying and sharing their memories, and people feeling really compelled to say, this is, let me tell you about my foghorn, or like the one that I know from my holidays or from my childhood. And you know, you were talking about living on the coast and things, and that it took you back, and that is that is this beautiful, amazing extra gift from the book, like this, how powerful people's memories are, and how when you give them something, then they give you these memories back. It's incredible.
Mm. And so was your first experience hearing a foghorn for real, in real life, so to speak, the performance of the Foghorn Requiem at Sutter Point?
I don't think it was, actually. I think just before that, around that same time, the timelines have got a little bit muddled, but I'm pretty sure around that time I also went to visit Nash Point in Wales, which is a really amazing, like really meaty sounding foghorn. It's brilliant, which is sadly silent now. They've switched it off for reasons that I don't quite understand. But it's the...
I'm just going to interrupt you there just for a second, just because I wish our audio listeners could see your face while you were describing the meatiness of that foghorn, because it's kind of the enthusiasm and the kind of the... it's almost like you're hearing the sound again as you talk about it.
There's like so many textures to them. And then when I started really digging into like listening to lots of different ones all at the same time, you're like, oh wow, these are all different. I suppose it's like people's voices. You think, well, I know what voices sound like, it's deeper, it's higher, it's this, but when you listen to them, they're all completely different. And that's by virtue of the machinery in a lot of ways. But the Nash Point one is really good. And it's in the film The Lighthouse with Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson. The massive horn that sounds throughout that is the root of that recording, which has had many things like done to it and augmented. But that general like timbre and movement of it is the Nash Point horn, I think.
Interesting. But the book opens and indeed closes with Sutter Point and the Foghorn Requiem there, which we get the impression as readers that there was something formative about that experience, like, or transformative perhaps would be a better word. Like, so could you just describe a little bit for people who haven't read the book what that performance was and the effect it had on you?
Yeah, you're completely right. That was the transformative moment when everything changed. So prior to that, I'd just been on my own little sort of reading, listening to stuff on YouTube and kind of just an interest in an esoteric sound. But at that performance was when the ideas around it, the context for it, its resonances and meanings, or multiple meanings, sort of spread out in front of me and were reflected in this crowd. And I realized that actually there was much more to think about and talk about, and that this thing was a symbol of something much bigger than I'd really considered, actually. The foghorn sounds. Its abrupt and terrific interjection comes from two rectangular black mouths, a colossal metallic holler that is stupefyingly loud. It floods my ears and shakes my guts. I am overwhelmed. I freeze. Tiny hairs rise on my covered arms. Its moaning blast ends in a gruff grunt that jolts me from my stupor. One eternal second of absolute and total silence follows, and the crowd around me erupts in the type of giddy laughter reserved for moments of awe. It is true oral obliteration. In June of 2013, I drove from London to the northeast with friends to see Foghorn Requiem, a vast open-air performance that assembled three brass bands with a total of 65 players on the cliffs at Souter Point Lighthouse in South Shields. They were joined by a motley flotilla of over 50 ships out in the North Sea that included a ferry and fishing boats, sailboats and lifeboats, ketches, yachts and tugs. At its centre was the almighty Souter Point foghorn, which sounded from the middle of the crowd over the heads of the brass players and out to the ships on the horizon. A voice of compressed air from hulking diesel engine lungs. It was a bright and blustery day, chilly under a blue sky. The crowd had amassed around the whitewashed lighthouse and foghorn building, square like an electricity substation, with two outside trumpets on top, gaping like black doorways tapering into two narrow necks. There were families with children on shoulders, people huddling in bright waterproofs around flasks of tea, couples with dogs, grandparents perched on camping chairs, kids lifted up to sit on the boundary wall of the lighthouse compound. And people like me, underdressed in jeans and light jacket for the brisk 11-degree summer day in South Shields. We waited, shivering and harried by the wind, for the performance to begin. As the brass players filed in, a quiet descended. This reverent silence was broken by one high, clear note, sounded by a single trumpet player from the top of the lighthouse. Then the brass began, and a sequence of sombre phrases was lifted by the breeze, the notes carried out to sea. The ships and boats replied in harmony, tuned to the notes of the brass, as if they were an echo from the vast landscape itself. Their answers came in staggered and idiosyncratic voices, the ferry loud and adenoidal, the small ships pinched and whinnying. Their conversation, between brass and boat, colliery and maritime, filled the blue-grey seascape from the cliffs we stood on all the way to the distant horizon, a mournful exchange on a scale much bigger than ourselves, as if these industries had been given voices with which to compare misfortunes. And then into this lament, the foghorn bellowed, a sound to call through fog and heavy weather that could reach 20 miles across the sea. Over the heads of the audience, it bellowed again. It sandblasted my ears with a force and power that diminished the brass and ships, those formerly huge sounds now mice to an elephant. Each time it sang, I felt more excited, more alive. It was shaped by the cliffs and water, from the first giddy interjection to a noise that gathered emotional power as it traversed the landscape. The final note of the requiem let the air drain from the foghorn's tanks, and as the pressure faded, the hardness of the sound was lost. It hummed, sang, in broken-throated keening, and when it no longer had the strength for that, it stuttered and wheezed until its last breath hissed like air from a punctured balloon. When silence settled, I stood frozen to the spot. A lump rose in my throat and my eyes watered. I looked around and saw tears and glazed looks in the faces of the crowd. Something had departed, and we were alone. In that last gasp, the foghorn had articulated not just its own death, but the death of an industry and all that was left behind. This was industrial music, and it meant something, only not in the way I was used to.
So let's talk about the invention of the foghorn, because of course we're talking about the foghorn, but there were, before the horn, there were various types of signals. There were bells, there were guns that were used to kind of to warn ships of fog, to warn them of danger. But this very particular sound, could you give us a sort of a little bit of a summary of the history that you give in the book about when it first originated?
Yeah. So, yeah, as I mentioned, I went looking for, you know, whose idea with this sound. It's completely absurd. And the kind of origin story that stuck, which I think I wouldn't want to be attach myself 100% to, but the story that stuck is that a guy called Robert Fowlis, who was a Scottish widower who moved to Canada and remarried, and he was in St. John in Canada, and he was walking along the shore in fog in the evening, and he heard his daughter's piano playing drifting across the shore towards him, and he noticed that the low notes carried better through the fog than the high notes, and this inspired him to build a foghorn. And this story was one that I heard or read, like some lighthouse keepers told it me. I read it in, you know, encyclopedias and every sort of reference book that had anything on foghorns said this guy invented it in 1853. But if you think about that story, and it took me a while to really come around to this, when if you think about that story, there's this massive hole in it. Like, why would a piano make you think of a foghorn? And by that, what he did was hook up a steam-powered mechanism to a horn that would be a lot louder, basically, than everything that was around at that time. And he was on a coastline with quite a lot of shipwrecks kind of around the Labrador coast, and Newfoundland, like St. John, kind of that Canadian coastline there. There is a lot of shipwrecks with people migrating across from Europe. So I kind of started digging into what had happened there, and there wasn't very much in the way of answers, but it really becomes this kind of fable or allegory or something, and it contains the because he was a widower and he'd kind of lost his first wife, moved over to Canada, remarried, and so there's this kind of grief in his story that, and he died in poverty because he never patented the foghorn, and this kind of melancholy is tied up in that story, really. It felt more like folklore to me when I really started to think about it than actually a factual story that meant anything. You know, there's no diaries that I could find any evidence of. There's no account of this day or this story, and I really don't know where it came from. It's quite possible that buried in some very obscure archive somewhere, there is like a letter from this guy, but I was never able to find it. So with that, I kind of almost like it better.
But in a way, that seems... Yeah, I mean, that seems also to fit with so much around the foghorn. There's the impression we get from the book. It's like it's at once a kind of a machine and a very kind of functional machine, although we'll get on maybe later to talk about quite how well it actually works. But, you know, and it's very sort of, you know, very much connected to industry and trade and marriage. And yet, on the other side, it seems to have inspired this story of this, we might call it its kind of origin myth, and also a kind of a whole range of kind of folklore and urban mythology, whether that's to do with, you know, comparisons ancient mythology, or whether that's to do with I think it's sort of a Sheffield sound system getting hold of one of these horns and using it as part of their performance. Like, what is it, do you think, about this kind of this very sort of functional object that makes it sort of so prone to generating these kind of stories of this folklore?
Well, I think there's lots of things going on there. That was one of the things I was trying to unpick, really. I think there is something inherent to sound, as like sound is a very transient thing, and as soon as you've heard a sound, it's already in the past because it's mm-hmm. left its place of origin and is in your ears and it's disappeared. It doesn't exist anymore as soon as you hear it. So in a way, all sounds are ghosts, like by their very physical nature. And I find that idea quite compelling and quite relevant to the idea of the foghorn, especially when we think about it now as something that when we hear it, we're hearing something from the past. It doesn't really function anymore, which we might talk about in a little bit. But then there's also, I think there is something about this, the absurdity of the machinery, the scale of the machinery. You know, these are the ones on the coast, like Souter Point, kind of have the engine rooms would be like two massive Victorian engines that kind of fill massive compressed air tanks. And then you've got this gigantic trumpet usually on a building that looks like a kind of electricity substation or something. Like, it's a very strange piece of architecture. It's very alien on the coastline, but we kind of take them for granted. You know, lighthouses are one thing, but foghorns are something else entirely. So I think because it is this light, there's nothing else like it, and it is very strange, and they're actually not as old as lighthouses by hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of years. So depending on how you count what you count a lighthouse as. So that idea of this kind of like thing that drops in and makes this colossal sound, it is like a monster, and it sounds like a monster. And people, when they got installed in places like in Scotland and stuff, complained about them as monsters and bulls and beasts. And so I think it's part of it is, you know, I really believe in folklore as a kind of way of understanding the world around us as well, and a way of also adding poetics back into reality. And I think the foghorn was just like perfectly placed in terms of its power, its sound, its architecture, the look of it, its absurdity, perfectly placed to kind of be this new container or something for sort of industrial folklore. And that became something that I kind of latched on to, this idea of lots of folklore being pre-industrial. And then, okay, so what is, and now we're kind of coming out of that historical period. What does the folklore of that kind of 19th century, 18th century industrial revolution look like?
And I guess the other thing as well, which you talk about quite a bit in the book, is the kind of, I guess, the medium that the foghorn works with, like fog itself. Because obviously, you know, fog has been part of, as you go into sort of like part of myths dating back to ancient times, but also in Victorian times, in sort of around the time when the foghorn was invented, very much in the sort of the stories of people like Edgar Allan Poe. There's this kind of, you know, fog has this very sort of looming, very sort of mysterious presence as well.
Yeah, and a very indefinite one. That was there's something very foggy about fog. I ended up in this tying myself in knots trying to write that chapter, just ending up writing this like sentence one be like, fog is fog, like it's a metaphor, it's a literal thing, and it is all these things at once. And I do love that about it, and I think it completely affects the way we hear the foghorn and what it means, because you've got this complete sensory flipping around of your usual experience of the world. You know, if you have normal vision, if you're not blind and your hearing's normal and not impaired, the fog and the foghorn is just this complete like inversion of the world around you in this instant that can come on in 10 minutes in some places like San Francisco. And there's something completely miraculous and magical about that, you know, and in that moment, then you are in a piece of like mythology or folklore, like everything's changed and there's nothing you can do about it. I love it.
I like it when you say that fog is fog, because yeah. I really enjoyed that, as you said, that attempt to define it, like the difference between a fog and a mist, for example, which if I understood correctly, it's to do with our perception of it, right? It's to do with the sort of the distance the observer can see through it or something like that.
Yeah, so the Met Office definition of fog is really about how far you can see, not about the sort of consistency of the fog itself as such. And there's something kind of, I mean, dealing with the sort of Met Office stats and on what fog is and things like that, when you get something like that, it's kind of a gift, actually, as a writer. Like, thank you, this is exactly what I needed. Because as soon as you have to have an observer at the heart of fog, really, for that. And there's some, philosophically, there's something very interesting about a weather state which requires an observer to verify it.
It makes me think that there seems to be a kind of repeatedly, and this comes back to this idea of the absurdity of the foghorn, I guess, that it's sort of with these kind of this concept of fog and the kind of the folklore that surrounds the foghorn itself. It seems that this was a device in a way designed to overcome fog in some way, to sort of neutralize fog, to allow ships to travel safely when this sort of this mysterious meteorological presence was there. And yet, in a funny kind of way, the foghorn has become part of the fog's mythology rather than overcoming it. Like, it's sort of it's got involved with it, it's shaped it, but it hasn't actually, it sort of set itself up in opposition to the fog and then in a sense became one with it.
Yeah, mostly because it didn't work. Well, it kind of did work, but it was more about power than it than success, I suppose, than its functioning. But yeah, this, yeah, the I was thinking a little bit about the way you make a landscape sound foggy if you are, if it's just a purely sound-based enterprise, and the way you might do that is with a foghorn. So yeah, it becomes representative of the fog, a symbol of it, and a sort of harbinger of it as well.
It's funny, so you said, like, you're beginning to answer that question, you said it's because they don't work. and that was one thing that again sort of just increased the charm of the foghorn to me, was this thing, not only, you know, you could imagine something, you know, an invention, something being invented that then doesn't particularly work, fine, happens all the time, but something that is invented doesn't particularly work and yet then gets adopted around the world as the kind of the, what is it, was it just sort of like the best option of available, or was it sort of like, or was there some sort of storytelling involved in getting the foghorn accepted?
Yeah, I think there was, I mean, I think with all of this, when we're talking about the rollout of like a piece of technology around the world, I definitely think there's not one easy answer, and it's a much more complex tangle of things, which again is like compelling and makes this thing foggy, which is very convenient as a writer. It was really, there were a lot of shipwrecks at that time, and it seemed like there was quite a lot of media pressure about it. Not media pressure in the way we think of it now, but there was a lot of coverage and calls to do something about it. Finding a massive horn, once they realised that sound on coasts is a very unpredictable thing to have to make sure somebody is getting 1 mile away, 2 miles away, 10 miles away, you really can't do anything about that because of the nature of the environment. Like, the whole thing conspires against you. If you've got cliffs, the sound's going to bounce around. If it's windy, the sound's going to get blown just completely out of earshot, very, very close to the cliffs. Like, if you have all of the things about the water, the cliffs, the sand, the weather, the wind, are conspiring to make that sound not travel, or travel weirdly, or travel in these really hallucinatory ways. So once they realised that with John Tyndall, and they realised it in John Tyndall's tests a lot, like the all the weird things that could happen, and the lack of controls for it, and that's when it becomes this battle against nature, like this a sound that's got to, you know, cut through this fog in really unpredictable and unmanageable scenarios, they just decided to use the loudest thing they could find. And there were other loud things, but they kind of abandoned. There was a lot of guns being used around the coast at the time, and they abandoned guns because you can kind of miss the retort of a gun over the other sounds on a boat. There was some whistles. There's quite a lot of whistles used in North America, actually, but and they're a bit snotty about them in the UK, being saying, oh, they didn't work very well. And obviously lots of places, when we talk about the rollout of this technology, it wasn't just like all of a sudden everyone gets an update and gets a foghorn. It was a very slow rollout of things, and only certain places could even get them because it depended on a lot of things to do with access and whether you had the space to build a whole engine room on the clifftop, which obviously rock stations out at sea couldn't do that. So they carried on using explosive charges into the 1970s. So as always, it's this thing which at first I found it incredibly frustrating writing the book, like where every time you try and find an answer to something, all you find is a series of buts, or well, perhaps, you know, this like constant tangents and constant caveats to any kind of answers you're trying to find as a researcher. But then I kind of realized that was the whole point of this project, you know, that history isn't like that, and you can't tell a story about a sound that's a linear thing that goes from A to B, because that's not how sounds exist, either in the moment or throughout history. And that became a big realization, I think.
Just as a quick aside, you've cast me into doubt now, because talking about the use of foghorns, but then also mentioning whistles, and now I'm just thinking of that line from the Van Morrison song "Into the Mystic," where he talks about, I think it's the foghorn whistle blows. I had one idea of what the sound was. Now is it a foghorn? Is it a whistle? Now it's sort of left me slightly perplexed.
Yeah, so the technical definition of a foghorn is the ones we're talking about, which is these big engine-driven horns on a coastline, usually at lighthouses, whereas, all ships have a horn to use in fog as well. So in sort of common usage, people often call a ship's horn a foghorn, and fog's horn, you know. There's a lot of slippage. So even in that, there's, you know, you can say what you took. I can define to you what I'm talking about, but that won't necessarily help you when going to look for references to it.
It's also talking about the sort of the place of the foghorn in history. Like you said, sort of it depended on, for example, if the coastline could accommodate it. But there does also seem to be, you write about sort of other factors which may have sort of influenced the positioning of foghorns and the way in which they were used. I mean, there's a moment, for example, you talk about sort of noise as a class issue. And obviously, particularly because the foghorn was born out of the Industrial Revolution, it's a sort of a steam-powered machine. There's very much this connection to the sort of the industrial sort of heartlands. I suppose I'm thinking specifically of the sort of the British industrial heartlands. And yet the places where these horns would have been located, I suppose, in a way, were places of, by and large, until this point, would have been spared the noise of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. Because, for example, the South Foreland, where Tyndall was doing his foghorn experiments, that's just kind of a bit round the bend from Dover, which would have been, you know, really busy town with a lot of factories and things like that. Whereas in other places, so up on, you know, if you're talking about perhaps like Fair Isle, up in Scotland, then that's going to be a place where they've had a lighthouse, but there's, you know, there's no other noise like a foghorn on the island. So it really was. And that kind of speaks to the way that we can't really say anything definite about coastlines either. As we were saying right at the beginning, that we all have an idea of what perhaps a seaside looks like. And that's one type of coastline. You get, you know, kind of cliff tops. And then there's very, very urban coastlines, and ones that are very industrial even. And the foghorn was in all of these different places. And even the urban places, though, so for example, on the Clyde, people did complain about the sound of it, even though they were used to like ships rattling around the bend, tooting their horns, the foghorns were still loud enough to be disruptive for people there.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and that feeds into a discussion you have in the book about what makes a sound a noise in a way. Like, it's sort of, I suppose, just thinking about it, is noise as a word it generally has negative connotations. I mean, I know it's sort of
which
musical genres that's been
object to. Which I, yeah.
Say again, sorry.
I strenuously object to the negative, like automatic negative connotations of noise. Obviously, because I think it has some musical or sonic merit often, and it's what I'm looking for. But there's a huge amount of literature on noise and trying to work out what noise is and exploring its meanings or purpose or manifestations. But actually, feel quite principled about the idea that. This idea of there being a binary between noise and music is a completely corrupt notion, intellectually speaking. Like, what you're trying to do there is draw a definition between what is art and what is not art, or what is beautiful and what is not beautiful. There's something deeply subjective about it that makes any sort of discussion which tries to prescribe one or the other actually philosophically redundant, I think. Noise is very much, and I think I say this in the book, like, noise is in the ear of the beholder, really. Like, what is noise to me is not noise to you, and what is noise to you might not be noise to me. And I think I did the vice versa, but vice versa. What is a yeah, but you get the idea. Like, there is no objective or platonic noise, and neither is there a music. I hold quite strongly to that as a principle.
And that definitely sort of seems to be borne out in the people that you speak to about the foghorn specifically, like the way in which they engage with the sound of the foghorn is, you say, so much to do with the context in which they lived with it, or perhaps haven't lived with it, or the context which they maybe lived with it in the past and no longer live with it now. And it was really fascinating to me to see that sort of people, for example, you talked about the lighthouse keepers who hated it, but then other people whose foghorns have been sort of decommissioned missing it like mad, like it's almost like a part of the landscape of their lives had been removed.
And was that something that you mentioned when you first emailed me about your memories of the coast? Was there a foghorn near you?
I don't think so. This is something I'm trying to remember, because there are definitely lighthouses along the Dorset coast. But I was thinking about this, having spent quite a few years ago now, about a month in San Francisco, and not remembering hearing a foghorn at all in my stay there. And you cross the Golden Gate Bridge on foot, which I did as well. And I was trying to think, like, was I... Because I do also have, you know, one of my ears is kind of quite significantly deaf, but, like, you know, not too deaf that I would not hear a foghorn. Yeah. And I was just trying to unpick, like, was it there and I just kind of accepted it as part of the background noise of the city? Was I there for a particularly fogless month and therefore didn't hear it? And just kind of reading the your experiences and also the different sort of memories the people you talk to sort of evoke, it really... on a personal level, left me with, like, lots of questions about sort of how I had processed and how I had remembered sound.
Yeah, definitely. I think that idea of getting used to a sound is one that we are all enacting every day. You know, we tune in, we tune out, loads of different things, you know. There are things that stick for reasons that I don't, in my daily life, that I don't know, that I always notice. I notice the bus coming to pick up the kid next door because it beeps its horn at the same time around 8 every morning. But there are things that I completely tune out, like I'll tune out the radio in the kitchen even when I'm making a cup of tea or something. And I think that that's one of the nicest things people have mentioned about the book. A few people have said, oh, it's made them think about what they're tuning in or into and what they're tuning out and the sound that's in their daily lives. And I think that's a particularly that's a particular thing to do when we're all stuck in the same four walls and in various forms of lockdown and COVID, and very much in a local area where, whereas we might be traveling and encountering lots of new, exciting sounds. So, but it's a way of kind of retuning your relationship to the environment to kind of pay attention to that a bit more, and to understand also, like you said, like you can't remember if there were foghorns. You may, there may not have been any, but you may also have just tuned them out, because once you're at a distance they're quite gentle and soft, so they're not kind of a call to action every time you hear them unless you're quite close. So that I was sort of quite amazed that even some of the lighthouse keepers just tuned it out. Like, your brain is such a curious, powerful thing, and those instances where you're able to sit and watch the TV in a lighthouse whilst tuning a foghorn out just speaks to the power of it to me.
Which also kind of raises a question of sort of preserving or sort of archiving the foghorn sound, because as we said earlier, like it's a difficult thing to record in any sort of any way that really does justice to the size of the sound. And then it's also something which the people who in many ways have the most experience with, as we just discussed, probably in some way tuned it out. And that, which for me, as I was reading your book, I had this kind of, this sort of growing sense of kind of melancholy associated with the foghorn itself. Like this idea that, I don't know, sort of buildings get sort of destroyed and then they're there and then they're not. And there seems to be kind of a sort of a definitive end and a definitive way to remember them, whereas this foghorn, as they're being sort of slowly decommissioned, replaced with sort of other pieces of more reliable technology, I don't know, it seems, there seems to be something quite sort of quite sad, I guess, in a way, the way it sort of, it seems to be fading from our lives rather than going out with a bang, I guess.
No, I agree. And I think that has something to do with the sadness around that has something to do with the scale of it as well. Like, we're talking about a huge, huge sound, and the idea that something so kind of muscular and robust could kind of fade away without us really noticing very much. And we just have these echoes left in sort of film and music. Is a strange and sad idea, and you start to think about, oh, what else is going that I haven't noticed? And I think there's lots of sounds that we're glad to see the back of, and it's really good that we do lose sounds, because otherwise we'd be living in this like onion skin of absolute chaos and not be able to navigate anything. But there is something sad about a huge, huge sound like that. And also because of what it represents, really. I do think that in the UK, particularly, as well as elsewhere, but it, particularly in the UK, the places where some of the foghorns were located were obviously massive sites for sort of the shipbuilding industry and other industries like that, that then were in decline at the same time as the foghorn was in decline. So it kind of begins to carry the weight of the industry and those workers, and sort of is almost not a collective voice, but it's a requiem for those industries, the requiem at the start of the book, not even for the foghorn. It's a requiem for the industries, I think, and those people who lost their livelihoods.
And yeah, I guess the kind of the irony is that sort of, obviously, you meet quite a few enthusiasts, so people who sort of, you know, have created art with them, or people who are sort of collecting the horns, or people who are sort of restoring or at least sort of maintaining the horns. But when, on the few occasions when you actually kind of, for example, in San Francisco, I think it is, or moments where you kind of visit places where there's actually sort of horns which are still operational. The impression you get from the book is that the people you meet are sort of so utter, I don't want to say
they're
sort
of nonplussed. It's okay, they're nonplussed.
Yeah, nonplussed. Okay, like, and completely almost baffled by the fact that anybody might take any sort of interest in or have any sort of affection for this object that they work with.
Yeah, I think that was something that I found most prevalent in engineers, actually, because they were so interested in the machinery, the sort of cogs and moving parts and engines and things. And, and you know, the engineer that was showing me around on the Golden Gate Bridge was kind of just a bit like, I don't really know what's happening here. What's this girl here for? Sound? Just on a, you know, it's just afternoon on a Tuesday or something. And I was sat there like, hello, yes, I'm really interested in this sound. But also then when I started to unpick it, you know, that's funny. And I'm aware of the novelty and like absurdity of that too, of, of trying to find these things and traveling these enormous distances to do it. But then when you hear one up close, you just understand why it's something that you should definitely search out. There's, it's such a huge sound. It's so metallic. It completely, it's a sonic experience that I think everyone should have, because it's not only in this incredible landscape, you know, a very dramatic landscape usually, even if it's a sunny day, but you feel it in your whole body. You like, you feel it in your guts, and you can feel your sort of epiglottis vibrating at the back of your throat. And it's completely overwhelming. And it has this, all these complex and multitudinous meanings to do with safety at sea and death at sea and civilization and loneliness all at the same time. And then when I saw, so I would kind of feel a little bit embarrassed when these engineers were sort of like, why, what do you want? Like, what, why are you here? But then go back to my research and be like, no, this is amazing. This sound is like nothing else, and I still couldn't find anything that quite matched up to it. Even by the end, I was like, I'm sure there's something else I can't think of, but I really, really never was able to. And I think there is something about your day job and familiarity, and you can sometimes stop. You know, it's quite stressful to have to see the absolute awe and wonder in something every single day of the week, isn't it? So I can appreciate them not quite loving it as much as me.
Yeah. We're going to have to finish in a few minutes, but one thing I'm curious about, like just particularly hearing that sort of you talk so passionately about the Foghorn just then, is, you know, the PhD is done, the book is done, you know, you're going to be talking about it as around publication. Is a Foghorn something which is going to be a kind of an abiding interest for you? Are you, is there, I don't know, what would we call this, like a horn head or something? Like, is it something which is now part of your life that you are going to, you know, are there horns around the world that you think, okay, before I die, I've got to hear this horn?
Well, I would like to hear them on the Golden Gate Bridge properly. And this maybe is a little bit of a spoiler for the book, but I went there and I didn't either, even though I saw the inside of the control room. So I would like to hear them in San Francisco properly and really sort of immerse myself in a sort of foggy, foghorny San Francisco properly. And then there's one on the coast of Tasmania called Tasmania. Yeah, Low Head, which is, has got a really funny part, but a lot of the ones that I really would have liked to hear, like I would have liked to hear the lizard fully functioning, because it was said to have this very strange and melancholy wail or something like that. And that one's no longer functioning at all. So more my, the ones that I really want to hear are all in the past, unfortunately. They're all silent and probably not going to sound again. But in answer to your question, do I think I don't think I'll manage to shake off foghorns. I think I have. I don't think there's another book on foghorns. I think I've done it. But I'm not going to be.
I think you've done it for foghorns generally.
Yeah. So I don't think I don't think I'll do much more writing about it, because I want to write about other things now. But definitely won't be putting this project to bed anytime soon, I don't think.
I think one thing I should say about the sort of the, when you say there's not another book on foghorns, it's sort of one thing I found talking to the booksellers, Shakespeare and Company, telling them we were going to be recording this podcast, is watching sort of their ideas about your book change from hearing like the initial premise, a book about foghorns. You get this slightly kind of baffled, sort of, okay, I'm not sure I'm going to be interested in this. Then the next step of sort of just me describing a little bit about what's going on in the book, And so you see their interest getting piqued. And then when they've read sort of a chapter or two, suddenly sort of like this sort of this passion developing. That's and it's a really kind of gratifying thing too. To see. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I guess it must be for a writer as well to sort of have
that
this thing which...
is what I had for the whole time I was researching this. So I'd tell people in the pub or something, or at parties, oh, I'm doing this thing about foghorns. And it would be exactly like you just described. They'd be like, this what? And there's that novelty aspect, and it is funny, and, you know, I'm not blind to that. And then you would say, well, it's a bit about this, and it's also kind of becomes about this. And then people's perceptions and ideas of it change, and then by the end of the conversation, they're like, oh, actually, I'd quite like to read that. And I used to sort of put myself up to that to make sure I was still on the right track with the book and had a hold of what was interesting about it and what was kind of profound about it as well. So I would do that in conversation as sort of training for myself to keep myself on track. And then I'm really glad that then the writing of this book has meant that, well, my agent had to have that experience many, many times. Then my editor had to have that experience many, many times. And now people like you and other people interviewing me have also been forced to, like, have these conversations where you go, foghorns? Oh, well, actually, like, it's about life and death as well. So I'm really happy to hear that I'm, like, subjecting everyone to these awkward conversations.
And I think it's like, testimony to the quality of the book and the sort of the profundity of the subject matter once you really dig into it. But, like, yeah, kudos to you for writing it. Kudos to White Rabbit for publishing it, because it's not an easy immediate sell, but, you know, I'm sure sort of after hearing you speak about it for the last 45 minutes, you know, people listening to this podcast are like, okay, you know, that's for me. And that's a sort of a very gratifying thing for a bookseller, but I'm sure for a writer too.
Yeah, totally. And I've been surprised by the response already and really grateful for it. And also just for the belief people have in it as an idea. Like, I believe in it completely, but the fact that other people do as well is a gift. It's been brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jennifer, that is all we've got time for. The Foghorn's Lament, published by White Rabbit Books, is available from the Shakespeare and Company bookstore. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you very much for having me. That was brilliant.
You have been listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast with me, Adam Biles. Links to the books discussed in this episode are available in the show notes, alongside information about how to become a friend of Shakespeare and Company. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please consider rating it wherever you listen. The intro and outro music is Mr. Ginger by the brilliant Alex Fryman, available on his album Play It Gentle. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care, stay safe, and thanks again for listening.